Hello, welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Dave.
And I'm Annie. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, TV show or book we were a fan of before we were married and that the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
This month, we have two special guests, our friends Ben and Emma, who previously joined us for our episode on The Princess Bride. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back. You came back.
We did.
Yeah, well, we thought it was only fair to do a Uno Reverso and have one that Ben hadn't seen before.
Nice.
Speaking of.
So, yes, Emma, you have selected our topic for this episode's discussion, the 1986 film Little Shop of Horrors. Why?
So we were watching TV a couple of weeks ago and a little clip from it came up. I can't even remember what context it was in, but it was a certain dentist singing about bringing pain to his clients. And I was singing madly along, as I always will when a song I know comes on. And Ben was looking very confused. And that is when I discovered that he had never seen Little Shop of Horrors. And I was completely horrified.
And you texted me and said, we need to do it for the podcast because Ben's never seen it. And I was like, I haven't seen it either.
I haven't seen it either.
Had you not? You said you'd seen it.
Oh my goodness.
I think I might have seen it a very long time ago because I didn't really remember anything when I watched it.
It's a cult classic!
Well, I think I've seen bits and pieces and I would probably have recognised almost any other bit than the bit with the dentist because that was complete shock to me.
Oh, I remember the bit with the dentist because I've seen that about all over the place.
Okay. Did it hold up for you overall?
It did.
Briefly, yeah?
I was briefly quite worried because I realised I'd probably not seen it for 20 years. And although I knew the music would still stand up because, fun fact, I was in Little Shop of Horrors in my university production of it as a member of the chorus, not as any of the titular roles. But yes, I knew the music would still stand up, but I couldn't remember what it... I couldn't clearly remember exactly what it looked like. I wasn't sure, especially as we have quite a new, shiny, very high-definition telly. Mm. And some stuff from my childhood holds up wonderful. Anything like Harryhausen still looks amazing in high-definition because it never looked high-definition back when we were in the right definition for that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was shot
so
on
it's
film.
Still wonderful. But some things on high-definition... Xena Warrior Princess, for instance, which I accidentally caught a little bit of. That looks truly atrocious in high definition.
Some things just suddenly look really cool.
Yeah, so I was really worried that those memories would be tainted, and I was thrilled to discover they really weren't.
Ben, do you want to give any very top-level overall
I had high expectations, and they were thoroughly blown out of the water. It's wonderful. I was very, very pleased.
Okay. Well, this is quite
That's
good.
That's it! I've won! The podcast is over!
Concerned that we might all pile on and you might be upset. I hated it.
I get the feeling it's very context sensitive as to when you're watching it, because when I watched it I really didn't like it, but now I wonder if I watched it again under other circumstances I'm backpedalling rapidly.
What, from like 2 days ago?
Yes, I'm shocking. Abandoning you in your
I'm quite surprised. Instead of 2 days ago, that your reaction to it would be vastly different.
No, not really.
No, good. Okay. Stay on my side of the table, Dave. I need some help. Anyway.
So, who would like to do a brief plot synopsis of the film?
Well, herein lies a very interesting question, because we may not have watched the same film.
That's a good point.
Theatrical release ending or director's cut ending, because they're apparently very different.
That doesn't massively surprise me, because the one criticism I did have of it was I thought that the third act seemed a little bit flat and not quite in keeping with what's the general tone of the story. So I did a little Google and Wikipedia of the original story, because it's... you know, it's an adaptation of a film, and I was like, and an adaptation of the Broadway musical, and I was like, oh, okay, that's why, because it's completely different to what happened on this the stage production.
So you did watch the director's
cut. We saw the All's Well That Ends Well.
The All's Well That Ends Well one. Oh, yeah. So that's the theatrical release. Yeah.
We watched the other one.
We've watched a completely different film.
Okay.
You haven't. You really haven't. It's literally the last 20 minutes. Yeah. It's different.
No, I've seen the theatrical release, and it was very, very good, but the back end didn't seem quite right, and this is that might explain why.
Okay. Shall I do a brief?
Yes. Well, we may need to do one each.
I'll kind of do both endings. So it's set in a flower shop, I guess, although to begin with, there don't really seem to be any flowers in the shop.
I mean, no flowers at all. And yet they can afford two employees.
Yeah.
Admittedly, one is essentially an indentured servant, but... True. Two employees in a flower shop doing zero business.
Can I already interrupt you in the middle of the first sentence? When do you think it's set from the style of what people are wearing and the cars and
50s.
60s. 50s. 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 50s is my thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we have Seymour and Audrey, who both work in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
And the shop is not doing very well. And so Seymour is kind of tinkering around with... Oh, no, he goes to... oh, my God. I should have written this down.
A Chinese florist.
Strange Chinese florist.
That is a reveal that doesn't happen immediately. No. So it feels like it shouldn't be the plot description.
He says he's been tinkering around.
He is a fan of exotic flora.
Yeah.
And he has something exciting which he and Audrey believe could revitalise the business.
But it turns out that during a...
Mysterious total eclipse.
not in the film.
A plant appears on this kind of stand that is manned by a strange Chinese man, reminiscent of gremlins.
Reminiscent of many things. So. I have that written down and done to translate later on.
And the plant turns into this incredibly horrible monster that feeds on blood. But in the meantime, lots of people think it's amazing and start buying loads of stuff from the shop. And he goes on the radio and he goes on TV and stuff to talk about the plant, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And eventually it starts talking to him and inveigles him into feeding it people. And in one ending, he feeds it Audrey because the plant attacks her and then she dies, and then he feeds her to the plant. And then the plant also eats him, and then the plants take over the world. And in the other ending, he manages to electrocute the plant and marry Audrey and go and live in a white picket fence house happily ever after, apart from the fact that there's apparently a plant in the garden. Anyway, so quite different.
That is quite different.
Yes.
Quite different. And in the meantime, Audrey has a terrible, terrible boyfriend who is abusive and horrible, and Seymour attempts to kill him, and he sort of kind of kills himself accidentally whilst trying to drill loads of Seymour's teeth. And that's the first victim that gets fed to the plant. Anyway, that was terrible. I should have
Is there
something
a podcast
down.
Called Plots Described Terribly? Because
probably.
I feel like that should go on as a potentially award-winning bad plot summary.
Yeah. And there's songs.
There are some spectacular
crucially,
songs.
Most of the plot is driven by songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it is a musical.
Shall we move on? Maybe
please.
I can cut a better synopsis into it later.
No, leave it.
Okay, that's fine. Right, facts. I don't know that I... Do I have any facts?
So everyone kind of looked in my general direction. I have a lot of facts. In fact, I have more facts than I have actual notes about the show.
I have one fact. The Mean Green Mother from Outer Space song was the first Oscar-nominated song to contain profanity in the lyrics, and also the first Oscar-nominated song to be sung by a villain.
Oh.
I think that's great because... Ben actually went, oh my gosh, they said shit, when it came in. Because you're not actually expecting it. And what actually, although it's actually a dark musical, you're not expecting profanities in what is quite a, otherwise quite a twee setup for a film. You know, the 50s vibes are quite strong. The lead character is a little Jewish boy who's been adopted or slash indentured by a Jewish flower shop owner in a very downtrodden part of Americana world, where the best thing that a woman can hope for is a tiny little detached house where she will own a microwave and a toaster that she will hug while singing about.
We will definitely get to Audrey, don't you worry.
And traditionally, after going through the facts, just to like put a thing for what we're going to get to in a minute, who is it aimed at? Is a question I'd very much like to talk about. But can we go to facts first?
Sure.
I've got a load of stuff.
Go for it.
So I'm going to try and minimise my...
You always say that.
...ridiculous list of stuff. So it's 1986. So this is coming out against things like Top Gun. Star Trek IV, Platoon. So it's directed by Frank Oz, famous from The Muppets, playing Miss Piggy, Fuzzy Bear. Also did Yoda, apparently, in all the Star Wars films. Previous things that he directed included Dark Crystal, which I think is fantastic, and Muppets Take Manhattan. It was originally going to be directed by Steven Spielberg, with executive producer Martin Scorsese.
Martin Scorsese.
It's going to be
director,
absolutely incredible.
Maybe I'm wrong.
I feel it would have been even darker if it had been Spielberg and Scorsese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's an adaptation of the 1982 off-Broadway musical, which the songs were written by a chap called Howard Ashman, who wrote a lot of the music for The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast.
Ashman wrote the words. Alan Menken wrote the music.
Ah, thank you, folks. I'm glad someone's paying attention, because it's obviously not me. And the musical itself was an adaptation of the 1960 film Little Shop of Horrors from Charles B. Griffith. The film is directed by Roger Corman, who is famous for lots of films with blood and gore in.
Okay.
Like Death Race
2000. I thought you said Frank Oz directed it.
No, maybe my notes don't make any sense. What you call? Maybe he's a producer.
Okay.
Sorry, folks. Maybe we should do your
definitely directed by Frank Oz.
Definitely directed.
I'll take
by
over
Frank
on facts for a second.
Yeah, go
the lead character Seymour is played by Rick Moranis. I can't remember whether that was before or after. I feel it must have been before Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Sometimes
before. Was big. It was
before. Yeah.
So he must be quite young. He must be significantly younger than any of us are in it. And yet somehow he still manages to look somewhere in his late 40s, even when he's playing a character who's probably meant to be only about 21.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the lead character. I think what it was a bit famous for at the time was the amount of sort of semi-cameos in it.
Yeah.
Two of which that I'm aware of that are named in the credits, which are John Candy, who plays the absolutely off-his-head radio DJ who does Seymour's first radio interview, and then Bill Murray in what I would argue is his best ever role as a masochistic dentist client.
Bill Murray
literally gets off on the dentist doing things to him in a scene that I cannot believe in a million years would make it past any censor today. Even though nothing actually sexual happens, it is an unavoidably
not very
sexually subtext scene.
Bill Murray notably improvised all of that dialogue.
Amazing. Oh, wow. That's very cool.
And it's brilliant because you can see how much fun he's having. I think the other cameos that I just really, really love, and these are ones that are not referenced in the credits because I think they did not have the slightest idea how big these people were going to get. Miriam Margolyes, she plays the one, the dentist nurse.
Oh, okay.
Dentist nurse. She has one line in it and everything else is just her face. She's amazing. And then my absolute favourite in the opening scene, which is a sung Broadway style opening number, Danny John Jules, a.k.a. Cat from Red Dwarf.
He's leaning against the lamppost.
Leaning against the lamppost, clicking his fingers and singing
that
opening number. And that was a delight to see.
Danny John Jules and Miriam Margolyes, they're there because they shot it in Pinewood. And so pretty much all the background people who have very little to do are going to be London-based. So, those are purely, as Emma was saying, they weren't intended to be cameos. They are since. They have become like little cult favourites. Also, honourable mention to David Guest as the incredibly hammy and awfully wooden first customer who wanted, and the second they put Audrey 2 in the window, comes through the door and buys 100 roses. That is
$100 worth of roses.
$100 worth of roses,
and
sorry.
For those of us who are plebs who didn't know who that was, he is.
David Guest is famously featured in the last film we talked about here, which was in The Princess Bride. He plays the evil guy there with the six fingers who
and
was killed by Mandy
Patinkin.
He's also the lead singer of Spinal Tap.
There we go.
Okay. So other people that were in it, Ellen Green, who hasn't really been in much else.
And it's baffling, isn't it, when you see what an Oscar-winning performance that was. That was sarcasm.
Okay. She plays Audrey, mostly because she was in the Broadway version, so she just came and did the same thing.
She premiered the role.
She was afterwards mostly famous for being in a thing called Pushing Daisies, which I saw recently voted as the most underrated one season TV show that there ever was,
with a slightly less annoying voice.
Let us hope so, dear God. So some other bits and pieces,
and also Steve Martin rounding out the the quadrangle of actors I hate who are in this movie.
There was also Jim Belushi.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, Christopher Guest. Everyone's in it.
Christopher Guest as well as David Guest?
Apparently.
Okay.
I mean Christopher Guest, not David Guest. I beg your pardon. I got the name wrong. Christopher Guest is the name I meant to say.
You mean Dave was right?
Wow. Yes, Dave was right. I was wrong. I can't believe I said David Guest when I meant Christopher Guest. David Guest is the strange man who was married to Liza Minnelli and definitely is not in that film.
Oh, yes.
Excellent.
This is possibly the most off the rails it's ever got.
Are they more off the rails than Princess Bride?
In over 100 episodes.
Well, yes. Well, I actually uploaded the unedited version first, which was possibly the most off the rails it's ever been, but that wasn't anybody else's fault but mine. Anyway, so, moving on.
So a couple of other little bits. As Ben says, filmed in Pinewood, the stage apparently was impractical to heat. It didn't say why. And there was so much breath condensation coming from the actors when they were doing their dialogue that they had to fix this problem. And rather than heat the situation, they got the actors to fill their mouths full of ice cubes to cool us down so much that they didn't see breath coming out. I was like, wow. And then carried on doing the acting anyway.
Okay.
There was a planned 2020 remake that didn't happen, which was going to star Taron Egerton, Scarlett Johansson, and Chris Evans.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
I am beyond grateful.
I can completely see who they would have cast. That should not have happened. I'm glad it didn't.
Wow. No. In terms of how well it did, it made $54 million from a cost of $25 million. I'm not sure where the $25 million went, apart from the big ending, which you guys didn't see in your version, which is like this massive special effects fest.
Hundreds of plants destroying the world.
Destroying the world.
That puppet was apparently very expensive.
I would imagine.
Because it was entirely mechanical.
It's got 91% on Rotten Tomatoes, 81% on Metacritic. It's very popular. And it was nominated for an extremely long list of awards and didn't win any.
Okay.
So.
Fair enough.
Right. Who do we think it's aimed at? What I mean is this a film for children? Because it's got puppets in it.
Most definitely not.
It's got sadomasochism in it. It's got people being eaten alive. It's got visible blood.
Oh, true. Yes.
It's got naughty words in it. It's definitely not aimed at kids.
The short answer is 1980s SNL fans, because half the cast are Saturday Night Live alumni. Musical fans, I mean, it had been an off-Broadway... it was one of the, I think, record-breaking off-Broadway run of the original musical. And, yeah, so people who... Dark humour and sci-fi satire and musicals, little subtext... commentary on 1960s America and etc. etc.
And people who would grow up to become Red Dwarf fans. I reckon the crossover is absolutely not. If you think about the puppetry of Tui and a lot of the monsters that they come across in Red Dwarf, there's a lot of crossover there in terms of the visual style, as well as the slightly slapsticky humour going on.
Muppets fans, indeed, a bit being a Frank Oz thing. Although,
also true.
Yeah.
Have you seen
Grown Up? Again, things like Avenue Q and Red Dwarf didn't exist at the time this film was made, so it sort of identified a market for them, possibly, which is why those things then got made. But
have you seen Meet the Feebles?
I have not seen Meet the Feebles.
We're not doing that.
Meet the Feebles is, I think it. Don't quote me. This
Peter
is wrong.
Peter Jackson, isn't it?
Is it? No, it might be. I think Frank Oz was involved in some way, but it's an attempt to do a properly adult Muppets thing. It's really bad.
Adult Muppets very thing is unpleasant. A sentence that you probably
no.
Yeah.
They do. No, Avenue Q is very well regarded, but...
Whilst It's rare for me to enjoy something which is billed as the top genre would be comedy. I like Avenue Q.
Fair enough.
Avenue Q we went to go and see at the local theatre down the road, and I do not know how they got in, but a mum would come in with her like two sort of 8-9 year old
oh,
kids
dear.
Thinking that it was going to be a thing, and about 5 minutes in she's like, nope, just dragging them out the back
Sled
door.
The theatre.
Do not know how they got into the thing. It was just amazing.
Anyway, where do we want to start? Why do you like it? Tell me. Educate me.
I think because I'm a musicals fan.
So
and
am
I. The songs are undeniably catchy. I mean, like I said, I've not seen it for 20 years and I could still sing almost every lyric.
I mean, being in a musical
does
catchy.
Help. I don't think I would enjoy it even a fraction if it wasn't. But I think the main reason I love it is because Audrey too. That was just some of the first puppetry that had me absolutely transfixed.
Oh,
Baby Tui is still, to this day, one of the cutest things I've ever seen. And then it grows up to be this giant, big, scary thing with this big, booming voice. And then you get more Little Tui, spoiler alert, at the end, all singing in chorus with him because he suddenly managed to in order to take over the world, and they all sing in harmony in slightly higher pitch. I just absolutely love it, and I was really worried that watching it in HD would ruin that, and it didn't in the slightest. It's still the cutest thing, and I'm actually, weirdly enough, in a complete coincidence, rereading a book in the Villainous Things series by C. Rochelle, which is a queer superhero villain series. And one of the characters has a Venus flytrap that is called Tui. And I'd completely forgotten that I was reading that at the same time as we were re-watching this. And it's just so adorable. I think that plant is the cutest puppet in the world.
I forgot a fact. It is related.
Go on.
Audrey Tui is played by Levi Stubbs, who is one of the singers from the Four Tops.
Yes.
So that's why he sounds excellent when he's singing.
Very true.
Yeah, he's by far the best singer in the entire thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I think shout out to Rick Moranis, because I think he would probably not be described on any call sheet as singer, but he has the most lines sung of anyone.
Yeah, he's
And he manages to do a surprisingly good job, bear in mind that he's up against someone who literally got the film gig off the back of her being the Broadway singer.
Mm. Yeah.
And who's still manages to sound worse than Rick Moranis because she cannot distinguish between her speaking voice, which is that stupid squeaky thing that I cannot replicate, which every actress since has felt obliged to do, including Julia, who did it in my university production, felt obliged to it. She pulled it off quite well, actually. Well enough that she managed
to
marry.
Julia, there you
she
go.
Managed to marry the guy who was playing Seymour.
Wow.
And they're still together, so well done, you
That's
two.
That's very cool.
But she managed to pull it off quite well. But every actress ever since has felt obliged to try and do that horrifically squeaky voice. But when she's singing and she suddenly moves into something that needs to be belted, she moves into a raspy, deep alto belt that does not in any way match the squeak. And it's still, I thought I'd would have got over this. And it still annoys the heck out of me.
I've got to assume Ellen Green did that because she'd been doing the role at that point for 5 years and presumably was like, that's where it had kind of evolved as a stage thing, and people had sort of enjoyed, in an off-Broadway context with a couple of hundred people in the room, probably quite enjoyed
different.
Her going from singing it in character with the squeaky voice in Somewhere That's Green and then just opening up the pipes for suddenly Seymour probably got a big laugh there, and so she translated it to the screen, and maybe out of context it wasn't so effective. But
I'm going to be slightly mean to Rick Moranis for a second, because his singing is fine, but his range is really small. So when he's singing, it sounds okay, but it also sounds really flat, because I think he's only got like a little bit over an octave in terms of range that he can do without going out of tune. So the amount of notes he's got to play with is not high. It's fine.
Well, his songs are mostly about moving the story on anyway. They're unfurling the story. So it actually doesn't need to have a great of great musical quality to it, unlike The Dentist.
Yes.
And that has so much character in it.
Yeah.
Steve Martin, who I absolutely loathe, I think, like Annie,
yeah.
In everything else I've ever seen him ever, will actively avoid watching. He is so good playing the Elvis-inspired bad boy dentist who is 100% off the rails, and he gives his all to the character, just like Bill Murray does to his masochistic patient. And it is the only thing I can bear to watch him in, and I think he does a brilliant job of it.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite funny that he's a sadist and he enjoys inflicting pain on his clients, and when he gets someone who actually wants that, he's not interested.
Yes.
He's like, get out of here.
Yes.
No use to me whatsoever if you're enjoying it.
The whole set design and the cinematography, as well as the choreography and putting the Greek chorus, they have names, and I didn't write them down. I'm super annoyed about
Crystal is the only one I can remember.
Ronette was one of them.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Which were shout-outs to the 60s girl trios like Diana Ross and Supremes.
Are they named in the film?
They are.
Yes,
named.
They are.
They're named in the credits.
In the credits.
Yes.
Crystal gets name-checked in the opening... one of the opening scenes by one of the other in the Greek chorus when they make that switch from being narrator singers to people actually on Skid Row, which is the name of the area that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
They make that switch seamlessly, and she gets name checked then.
I mean, that whole thing is one thing that I really liked about it. The staginess of it, way the set is, it's so obviously, even, it is really obviously a stage set and looks like a Broadway production, and I think that's a good thing. I think it's a musical and it's not pretending not to be a musical.
Well, yeah, and it's not because we've made the switch to HD. It looked like that in standard definition on a 12-inch screen.
It's deliberately
and would have looked like
made.
That in 35mm in the cinema
and
as well.
That's why it works well as a modern thing to enjoy, despite the fact it's old.
You've answered the question before I even asked it, which was, did they deliberately design it? Did they
absolutely
design it to make it look like they just filmed the stage play?
There are bits that it, very deliberately, apart from the bit that the bit of the scenery that the stars are directly interacting with, say a bit of the till, the backdrops are deliberately made to look like they're painted because they are painted.
Yeah.
And that is true
okay.
of the house in somewhere that's green.
Yeah, that
so
was
some
a very...
That, sometimes that is an actual house that she's interacting in. Sometimes it is a painting on a backdrop.
Yeah, that was a very clear production design choice, and I think it worked. I really, really liked it because I think it wasn't taking itself seriously. It was leaning into what it was, which was a off-Broadway musical. And of course, I'm an absolute sucker for anything Alan Menken. For people who don't know who Alan Menken is, all of your favourite 90s Disney, basically. Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Pocahontas, like the whole...
Wow.
And more recent stuff like Enchanted. He is that sort of... slightly schmaltzy Disney sound, and this was his big breakout thing. This was his first major thing he did, was the Little Shop of Horrors, which is what, and on the strength of this is why he got Little Mermaid. So Little Shop of Horrors is responsible ultimately for the 90s rebirth of Disney.
And actually, if you listen to Part of That World and Somewhere That's Green.
Oh God, it's the same song, isn't it?
You can hear it. Yes. I genuinely recommend listening to this. It is the same bloomin' song, but instead, she's dreaming of walking on the sand rather than, his father, he knows best.
Oh dear God.
I will get back to Audrey. Audrey was the main thing. Despite all of the actors that I hate, the type of humour that I hate, the kind of, I don't know, schlockiness of it that I'm not a fan of, but I appreciate the choice. Audrey was the reason I didn't like this movie.
I can empathise with that.
Since you mentioned the schlockiness, can we go on to that for a bit?
Sure.
It's unexpectedly grim in places, in a way that I presume is supposed to be funny. I did struggle a little
it's
bit.
It's dark humour, definitely.
So... what is even Rick Moranis' character's name?
Seymour.
The part of my brain that stores names does not work.
So the only thing that I really knew about this film was that I've quoted it for decades without really understanding why. because I do say feed me Seymour, and now I probably can never do so again. Anyway,
So Seymour's decided he's going to go and confront Audrey's terrible dentist boyfriend, and he's got a gun, and he's got to go and kill him. And it turns out that the guy has plumbed himself into the nitrous oxide, because that's one of the ways that he gets off. And he says he's going to turn it off, and instead snaps off the handle and asphyxiates himself on nitrous oxide. At which point, Seymour decides, I'm going to feed him to Audrey, but before I feed him to Audrey, I'm going to chop him up into little bits with an axe.
He does not decide that he's going to. Audrey requires him to.
Audrey 2 requires him to.
Despite the fact that later on, Audrey 2 is perfectly happy eating people, whole. That could be argued that that is because Audrey 2 continues to get bigger throughout the film. That puppet just keeps getting bigger and bigger and that is where the money is.
I think, to be fair to the plant, at the time when the dismemberment happens, it probably wouldn't have been able to eat him whole.
So there's two interesting things on
there.
The first one of which is, I wonder how many versions of the plant there were. I didn't really keep track, but there must have been...
There are a lot.
Five or six different sizes?
Yeah.
I mean, there's at least three handheld.
Wow.
And that's before, because there's the starting one, then there's the one where it's first sort of displayed in the shop window, then it's bigger again by the time that Seymour is on the radio and it's going to eat that woman's bum. and that's just the handheld ones. And I'm presumably that last one, when he's in the waiting room to go into the radio DJs, that is Rick Moranis puppeteering that.
Because
that is a hugely interactive bit. It's very sort of Muppet coded in the way that's all done. And then the plant is a freestanding plant on the floor and continues getting bigger and is at its biggest only by the final scene when it has all its little ones singing chorus. That really is where all the money went.
Yeah, must have been.
It definitely didn't go on Audrey's wigs.
What was your point?
The
dismemberment is done in silhouette.
Yes, but...
And all of the pieces are wrapped in newspaper.
And there is no visible blood into there. The
plant. Yes. I don't know, I had a weird moment when watching it of thinking, you could have filmed a lot of these bits and then just put them in a different film, which had a different soundtrack and was made into, like, here is a slasher horror film, and just done exactly the same scenes and then chopping things up with an axe and just showed it.
The butchering silhouette scene could easily have had a Psycho track over it, and it could have just been a completely different film.
Yeah.
Completely. Which is why it's not a kid's film.
Well, yes. But it's interesting you brought up a point there about Audrey telling Seymour to do stuff. And he spends almost the entire film doing whatever anybody tells him to do, including the killer plant that tells him to, first of all, you know, feed the plant a lot of his own blood, and then, you know, go and murder people so I can eat them. And he's like, sure, rather than, I don't think I should be killing people.
Would he have killed the dentist if the dentist hadn't inadvertently killed himself?
He was pointing a gun at him at the door.
A gun and actually being willing to pull the trigger are very different things.
And he only feeds Audrey. He saves Audrey from the plant and then feeds her to the plant after she's dead.
I mean,
so he only feeds corpses to the plant. He knocks the shop owner into the plant, doesn't he?
Yes. So, well, he
is that deliberate? I don't think any of the...
It certainly looks deliberate.
I think they structured it to try and make it look like he. Seymour never really
actually kills anybody.
Did the murders as such, but he's certainly not a blameless character.
He's not a massively stellar step up.
He's not. You do need to remember the context, and this doesn't excuse it, but you do need to remember, and it's mentioned several times. He was an orphan. He was abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
The shopkeeper took him as a baby, and has. You see quite clearly that he's living in a cellar. He's not had a great upbringing with Mr. Mushnick. He has not had much opportunity for independent thought, having been raised essentially as an indentured servant to this man who just apparently went and picked him up at the orphanage. So that is kind of behind a lot of his... And he does admit himself, again, in song, that, you know, there's not much to him. He just, he's a bit of a loser. He knows it. He's fully aware of it.
It's just, it's a little bit of a step from saying, he's got a gun, he may or may not shoot him too, but he's perfectly happy to chop a body up with an axe. It's
like, again, okay, perfectly happy. Fine. Do you see his face throughout it? He's pretty horrified about what he's doing. He does still do it, so... Yeah.
And then after the dentist has died, and suddenly Seymour, you know, she is saying, oh, I have, you know, loved you all along. And then very shortly after that, he seems to be not, you know, particularly cut up about feeding her corpse to a giant alien plant.
No.
I think by that point, he's thoroughly brainwashed by the thing.
Well, yes.
Which brings me on to sort of contextualising the film. I think it owes a lot to things like, well, the original 1963 film, which owes a lot to Invasion of the Body Snatchers and that whole, that sort of dark side of 1950, of Americana 1950s, early 60s thing. The Red Terror, McCarthyism, fear of the outside alien invading and subverting America. That was a huge undercurrent of the same period of history that the film is set in and is somewhat satirising.
That's really interesting, because I've no idea what the black and white film is like. I assume the black and white film was also a comedy, is it?
Yes,
not?
Also a dark. Okay. I read that's enough. Also a dark comedy, very similar plot to the version that you saw, where ultimately the monster wins and takes over America.
Wow!
But yes, it was presumably chosen because of its that satirical edge to it. Which, I don't know, gives it a little context that maybe makes it make more sense.
Yeah. I mean, there were a whole load of films around at that time. I really like The Blob. Have you seen The Blob?
I don't want to say no.
I'm not sure I want to watch again. No, I would. I would definitely want to watch again. We will see.
We can potentially cycle back sometime.
Yes. But, yeah, it's interesting in the version that we saw, Seymour gets eaten by Audrey at the end. I'm not entirely sure what the director's trying to say about the futility of human existence when basically all the characters with names end up dead at the end.
Well, I think I prefer it that way.
I think there's a vague look on Wikipedia. I think there is a someone's tried to do a Marxist commentary about it, basically saying that it's all about the ultimate self-consuming nature of capitalism. Because they, you know, the only reason Audrey was ever indulged by Seymour was in order to be able to get money and escape the horrible poverty grind.
And the whole point about the end is the guy comes and says that he's taken a cutting of the plant and he's going to put it in every house in America.
Yeah.
And there's like a scene of lots of people with shopping trolleys doing runs on the shops to try, and everybody needs to get a baby Audrey. So, you know, they only have themselves to blame, really.
Yeah, and I think that's frankly a better ending, really, than the alternative version, which is the one we saw last night, which is where they live happily ever after, because I don't really think anyone should be living happily ever after after what they've gone through. Yeah. I mean, human Audrey is essentially blameless and has had a horrible life, so she probably deserves her white picket fence, but yeah, possibly but not with someone not who with was him, comfortable no. feeding humans
yeah.
to okay. a man-eating plant in order to get fame and fortune.
I want to talk about Audrey now. We're segueing straight in from Emma's point.
I was just going to say, since we're talking a bit about bits that were grim, and it's also kind of connected to Audrey, we have the comedy plant sexual assault as well.
Oh yes. Yes.
Do you want to leap into this?
Audrey's entire existence is, I have a terrible boyfriend, and I know he's a terrible boyfriend, but he makes money, he makes good money, and he's the only fellow I've got. That's not a great start. And she switches immediately, almost the same day, from him having disappeared and being fed to the plant, which she doesn't know at the time, to Seymour, who fed him to the plant. I would say the one decent thing is that she does fall for Seymour while he is still a supposedly nice, sweet young man who looks a bit nerdy, and he doesn't require a transformation for Audrey to see him as a better choice. But he doesn't end up being a better choice. And the one that really made me really squirm, I've done terrible things, Audrey, but never to you, to which she says, I want you to.
Oh, I missed that.
At which point I nearly switched it off and threw my laptop out of the window.
I missed that.
I didn't catch that line.
Admittedly, it's technically because she's asking him to feed her to the plant after she's dead.
Oh, that's why we missed that, because it wasn't an hour.
But she still said it in response to him saying, I would never do terrible things to you.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh! And that was after the plant had kind of sexually assaulted her as well. So, not great. So, I don't know. You either get the Audrey who goes from one terrible person to another terrible person and supposedly gets what she really wanted, which was to be a dream 50s housewife, which is not great from a feminism point of view on any level. Or she dies and gets fed to a plant. So, I'm not really sure what the female aspect of this film is trying to say on any level.
Well, I mean... Yes, I don't like that either, and I like the film despite Audrey, not because of Audrey. But having had some 90s, 50s housewives in my family, I'm very aware that certainly amongst a certain working class level, there was very much a strong... The most important thing is that you find a guy and that he's professional and makes money.
Absolutely.
And anything else really doesn't matter. And so the fact that I'm uncomfortable with that doesn't change the fact that that is very true to what a lot of working class 90s, 50s women lived. So
absolutely.
I'm not okay with it, but the fact that it's, you know, if we as women didn't watch any films where women historically were treated badly, we'd have a really short list of stuff to watch because
very
women
true.
Are treated badly.
Shout out to our appearance, a previous appearance on this podcast.
I have been saying that a lot in my book reviews.
In deference to the horror every time our friend, mutual friend Joe shows whenever I say it doesn't pass the Bechdel test. Obviously it doesn't pass the Bechdel test. But 1950s housewife experience, certainly from what I know within my family, didn't pass the Bechdel test.
Well, no, absolutely.
In real life.
And it is important to tell those stories. But in a 1986 musical depicting that time, I was kind of hoping for some kind of commentary on that. Or
do you not think somewhere
like
really
gets
a commentary on it? Because they are clearly... taking the piss out in the way it's shot, they're clearly taking the piss out of Audrey's dream.
Yeah.
She hugs a toaster.
I mean, fair.
She says the line, he's father, he knows best.
Blah. But then in the theatrical version, that's what she ends up with, which is like...
That's why the theatrical version isn't as good as the director's cut or the
stage
play.
Where she gets eaten by a plant.
Yeah, that's a better...
But you've
better
none
it's
of
a,
these things
it's
are
a
good.
More narratively satisfying outcome.
But you've always got a thing that when you are replicated something from the past, do you do it as it was then with the attitudes that they had then? Or do you modernise it in some way to put the attitudes of the present day on... what people would say.
Yes,
the
fair enough.
The past. It's a whole ongoing thing.
It's okay for the time. Doesn't mean I have to like it.
But there was a guy on YouTube recently was talking about reading what I've been doing, a lot of 19th century literature, and he was saying, what these books have in common, I mean, apart from all the racism, obviously, is... and
all of the women in... Well, not all, but some of the women in the 1850 Chilean novel that I read this month were absolutely in control of their destiny. And that was written in 1850 by a man.
And it's probably worth mentioning that she does have a slight ally who is saying that she shouldn't have to put up with this as the voice of reason. And it is actually the only redeeming factor about Mr. Mushnick, because he repeatedly tells her that her dentist boyfriend is no
terrible.
Good for her
yes.
and that she should leave
agreed.
Him.
Yeah,
he
fair.
Does do that. He's not actually a very nice character
oh, yeah.
if you take how he's raised Seymour. But that is his one redeeming thing. And I feel it is the filmmakers going, this is not okay.
That is
but
fair, yes. That
the
relationship,
whole point is that
yes.
both she and Seymour both equally have awful views of their self-worth. And Audrey actually repeats to Seymour a line, I think it's the girls in the Greek chorus say to her about not being aware of needing... more self-worth.
Mm.
She repeats that line to Seymour towards the end of the film. they're both terrible.
And you're right that the relationship with the dentist is highlighted as being absolutely terrible and should not have. Yeah, that's true.
I was planning at the start of the show and somehow forgot to say it is a brave choice from all the people involved to create a thing that has no actually really likable characters. Some of them are very funny, but there's nobody there who you'd think I'd want to go down the pub with these people. Yeah.
I'd like to go to the pub with Audrey too, as long as absolutely. I know with absolute certainty they weren't planning on eating me.
Yeah, fair. Which is why the ending where Audrey 2 and Audrey 2's spawn get to take over the world is the better choice.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the films that were out at the same time. I think one that's probably more relevant to understanding why it was made the way it was is probably Back to the Future from that sort of time.
Yeah.
I think that the filmmakers knew that that 1950s America was not a golden place is important. And just like Back to the Future, that was for the Gen X people watching it, having had their parents talk about how lovely it was when they were little. And it's an anti-conservative film, really. It's a saying, no, this whole period of time and everything, all of this was actually, we like looking at it and we think, oh, this was wonderful because it was a time of wonderful material growth and everything.
Mm.
But actually it was immensely conservative and anti-feminist and all of these things. So I think that's, I don't know, it's more enjoyable and more satisfying, perhaps, at least, if you bear in mind it doesn't have a happy ending and the characters are not nice because they're not supposed to be nice, because it's talking about a time that's, it's trying to unsanitize that sort of happy days view of America.
Well, it's the home and gardens
exactly.
view of it, which is, you know, at odds with the reality of Skid Row, which is actually closer to the truth than we like to believe.
Is there anything more that people have got before we
anything else?
Nip into...
One thing I did forget about and was amused to see, bearing in mind that we live on an ex-council estate in North London, which will become relevant in a second. I'd completely forgotten that the dentist was hooked on nitrous oxide.
Mm.
And he talks about, you know, he takes it recreationally. He doesn't just have it when he's working on his patients in the surgery. He carries it around with him and offers Seymour a hit of it when he meets him in the alleyway outside the shop. And I just was not expecting to see that come full circle, because, of course, the biggest drug use amongst young people in London is nitrous oxide, and the areas around our house are just littered constantly with nitrous oxide.
Have you not
capsules.
Seen the tiny little and metal cylinders everywhere?
Oh,
on
that's
the
what they are.
That's
and,
nitrous oxide.
And it's also one of the biggest strains on Metropolitan Police at the moment is not drink driving, it is driving under the influence of nitrous oxide. And if you're interested in more on that, there is an article on that on London Centric that has done a deep dive into it, because it is absolutely fascinating. But yeah, I was not expecting to see nitrous oxide as a drug use thing come out of an 80s comedy horror and make it all the way into the reality of youth London life now in 2025.
So at the end of the show, we normally talk a bit about diversity. We talked about gender a lot already because of Audrey. Could you talk about race for a little bit? I thought it was interesting that we had the three black singers who are really good, but no black characters. I mean, to be fair, there's not actually that many characters in the film.
The extras are quite diverse.
The extras are. I mean, Danny John-Jules is one of many chorus singers.
But named characters, the only one who's not white is Tui, and then because voiced by...
I mean, it's really interesting because for a character that... Levi Stubbs.
Levi Stubbs. I did remember that correctly. But he is an animatronic plant.
I mean, this is the thing. He's obviously not a black person, but it's so incredibly black-coded.
It is.
It's just really interesting.
But I think it's tricky with the diversity one thing, because wasn't 1950s America very segregated?
Oh, yeah.
It was.
So you wouldn't really expect...
fair.
To see.
Yes.
True.
And it's also slightly pushing it to court to refer to Seymour and Audrey and Mr. Mushnick as white as such. They're not wasps. They are very obviously Jewish characters.
And then what you were saying about old Chinese man gives plots to people who then go off and do it is a very, very common thing.
I wonder how much tongue-in-cheek that was.
But then he just takes the money from a guy who says, I want this plant that's on your table, because it's not his plant.
Yeah. Mm.
It arrives in a bolt of lightning during this eclipse.
Oh.
So it's not like the Chinese guy knows what he's doing, because the plant wasn't there 5 minutes before.
You've allowed me to crowbar in the other thing that I wanted to do, which I didn't know how I was going to manage to do it, by mentioning the eclipse, which is the total unexpected solar eclipse is no cause for alarm, which is like basically on the newspaper, is also a line in Flash Gordon.
Oh really?
Wow. That's wonderful.
Which is just great.
That's very cool.
Layers upon layers in this thing. It's great.
I know it because that quote from the film is in the Queen song Flash Gordon.
Ah.
Where they cut the quote out of the film, so that's how I know it.
Okay, so I think that about wraps it up for this month's discussion. Time for the ratings. Regular listeners will know we use a standard 5-star rating system, which with half stars allowed, at which point our previous guest from a couple of episodes ago said, so it's just a 10-star system, rating system then. Dave, what is your rating for Little Shop of Horrors? I'm making you go first.
Oh, thank you for that. I think I'm going to give it 2.
Okay.
And was between me and the door, I fear for my life.
Well, I've written down in my notes 1 star? 2 stars? 1.5?
Christian, between you and the katana.
Well, I'll say that, yeah.
I think I'm probably going to, because of the interesting discussion that we've had, where people have pointed out things to me, I am also going to land on 2.
Fair enough.
Ben?
Okay. I want to go in with 5 for all the reasons that I've talked about here. The music is absolutely banging. The cameos and the character acting is absolutely wonderful. The puppetry, that I'm having built stage puppets in my youth, I have nothing but absolute admiration for the people who put that together, who would have all been working up in, very near here in Enfield and over in... where they met the films, Pinewood area. I'm going to knock the version that we saw, the theatrical release, down to 4.5, because I do think that the original ending, having not seen it, but the concept of it sounds so much better. So I'm going with 5, but 4.5 for the theatrical version.
Okay. Emma?
I am also going with a 4.5. I still think the music is borderline unbeatable. I wouldn't hesitate to recommend just about anyone watch it. I think it's hilarious and entertaining. I'm knocking 0.5 off purely because of Audrey's voice.
Whereas I think Ellen Green's characterisation of that was absolutely bang on. So yeah.
Okay. But you still loved it, though.
I absolutely adored it. I
Yay.
Possibly love it even more now.
Well, I'm glad this was more successful than the last time in terms of sharing your loved media.
It's nice that both couples have absolutely agreed, respectively, which was good.
I'm very relieved that Ben has not decided to shit on my dreams. But yeah, doing to Little Shop of Horrors what I did to the Princess Bride.
How possibly could I? No.
Yeah.
So...
Now,
do I dare even ask? You're doing a face. I have concerns.
You're the one who asked me to go dark.
Oh, God.
But I'm actually not, because I have also been wanting to have more joy and pleasure in my life. So I am going to go with Lost in Austin.
Is that dark?
No,
oh,
that's
okay.
My point.
Oh, right.
I have
okay.
Dark still in the list.
Okay.
But I don't want to go dark this time, so
is
we're going to go with...
Is that a film?
No, it's
TV series?
three episodes TV series.
Okay. This is not the one with what's-his-name in his shirt in a lake.
No.
No, that's Pride and Prejudice.
That's the actual Pride and Prejudice, which we do not speak of.
I'm only bringing this up because I know you hate it.
Well, thank
All
you.
All versions
okay.
or just...
Okay,
no,
Angels
no, just,
in America, then.
Just that version.
You asked for it.
No,
if
no.
you want, if you
no, no,
if you're
no,
going to be mean to me, we'll go dark.
Let's stick with Lost in Austin. It's all fine.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I'll keep Angels in America for another time.
Yes.
You can look forward to that.
Okay.
Right. So that's it for this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you to Ben and Emma for joining us for our discussion this month.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell us about a time when you shared some media you love, and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can always email us at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.
Please join us next month to find out what Dave thinks of Lost in Lost 2.
Whether or not Annie still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.
Bye. Bye.